The Tom Woods Show, episode 724.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, one of the first things you figure out when you become a libertarian is that all the U.S. presidents your teachers told you were great were terrible. Learn the true history of the U.S. presidents and their crimes against liberty in our new course on the presidents. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hey, everybody, it's almost that time. Bob Murphy and I are hosting a cruise in October 2016. It's the Contra Cruise, named after our podcast, Contra Krugman, and we've got a lot of terrific things lined up. How could this not be the best time you've ever had? Check it out at contracruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I am sharing with you my appearance on the Milo Yiannopoulos show. I've had Milo on my show before, and he returned the favor just the other day on his brand new, or relatively new, new-ish podcast, The Milo Yiannopoulos Show, which I recommend you check out. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/724. We talked about a whole bunch of things. I didn't realize he wanted to talk to me about education, so I wasn't really prepared for that at first, but education, higher education, what's wrong with it? What, if anything, can be done? Then Trump comes up, Gary Johnson comes up, and some other fun topics. Rudy Giuliani, heaven help us, comes up. Now, if somehow you don't know who Milo is, all you have to do is type in Milo to Google, and you will find out. He is an editor over at Breitbart. He is a provocateur extraordinaire. He has been the terror of so-called social justice warriors on university campuses, particularly across the United States. And he is, I don't really quite know how to describe him, but I'll just say he has built up a tremendous amount of notoriety. He got booted off Twitter permanently. He's a phenomenon. It's quite an interesting thing to observe. So I think you'll enjoy this segment. Here we go.
Tom Woods, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this is not the first time we've spoken, is it? I, in fact, was on your show once upon a time, and have now, I don't know, people seem to be quite like me. I'm becoming quite popular since. I am attributing this, of course, as you suggested before we started recording, to the Tom Woods bump.
Of course. It happens to everybody on my show.
This is probably a well-established phenomenon in conservative media, I'm guessing. People on your show sort of go to great heights of stardom once they leave.
People are walking over their own grandmothers to make sure they can get on my show. But let me tell you something about when you were on the show. It was episode 576. I remember tomwoods.com/576.
Gosh, this show's never getting to 576. Good grief.
Get out of town.
I'm going to be canceled way before that. I'm amazed I got into double digits. Can you believe tremendous. There is an advertiser who I have not scared off yet? It's TrueCar, the used car people. They have come back week after week after week, 20 weeks of ritual abuse, and they still keep coming.
At some point, the fact that you have a big audience does help. Well, I do want to mention, when I had you on, I had only recently become familiar with you. I wasn't prepared. I totally lost control of that show. You ran that whole show. And
I'm sorry. I do have a tendency to talk.
I got to get this guy back on just to show my audience I do know how to run the show after all.
Sorry. I do have a habit of talking. I give very long answers to very simple questions. Well, for those who don't know, we've all got off to a wonderful start. And as you can already tell, Tom and I are destined to be wonderfully good friends when we eventually run into each other in real life. But Tom is an American historian, a libertarian educator, political analyst, and an author. You're also a New York Times best-selling author, in fact. You've published how many books? It's over 10, isn't it?
Well,
12
it's
books.
12, yeah.
You've written extensively on American history, contemporary politics, economics. You identify, this is a community that has been entreating me to pay attention, has been attempting to seduce me. You identify, don't you, as a sort of anarcho-capitalist and a proponent of the Austrian School of Economics.
Now, yes to both, yes.
Yeah, no, I've met some of the ANCAP people. I met them in Acapulco in Mexico this year. And they're very nice people. They're very, very nice people. Very interesting, very smart. Sometimes a little bit rude about the military, and I don't like that very much. They can be a little disobliging. But otherwise, very intriguing, very interesting people. And I loved, anyway, I loved being on your show. This episode, as those of you who have been listening assiduously, as I hope you have, to the first half will know, it is an update on my Unopolis privilege grant, and also a general show about education, which is why I wanted Tom on. This is such interesting perspectives on education. I want to just dive straight in with you. Now, you were an instructor for Ron Paul's homeschool program. Now, for people who don't know what that is, tell us what it is. And also, do you still think that public education is worth it and gives a sufficiently diverse educational experience? Or do you think, given all of the nonsense and craziness that's happening in American college campuses, do you think those sorts of homeschool programs are going to become more and more popular as time goes on?
I say the worse, the better. I mean, the worse the government school system gets, the better for our program, because you'll have parents saying, there's no way I can send my kid to this indoctrination factory. It gets worse and worse all the time. Yeah, what Ron Paul wanted to do when he got out of Congress was to think about the long term. Because to me, if I were to ask, what is the biggest obstacle to getting my message out, it is unfortunately the indoctrination factory that almost everybody attends, because they come out all thinking the same way, all repeating the same platitudes, all repeating Orwellian platitudes that are so completely at odds with reality, but it's been drilled into their heads again and again, and they're ready to take their place on the what I call the 3x5 card of allowable opinion. They have exquisitely correct opinions on absolutely everything. I want to smash and burn that. And the idea of the Ron Paul curriculum is not just – it's not that it's going to propagandize your kids, but it's going to let them know there is more than one way of thinking. There is another way of looking at this. If we offer a government course, it won't be the typical government course, which is a course that comes up with a series of excuses and rationalizing from doing X, Y, or Z. We'd all be dead, or our limbs would be blown off because of exploding computer monitors if it weren't for the government. There are answers to that. So the idea of the curriculum is it's a K-12 homeschool curriculum. It's self-taught, so it's not a huge burden on the parents. The idea is not only do you get a liberty perspective, which is left out, completely left out of the traditional curriculum, but you do learn also the other fields. You learn the sciences and English and writing. But we also teach the students how to communicate, how to start a blog, how to start a YouTube channel, how to be an effective public speaker, how to start a small business, how to write good advertising copy. In other words, how to promote yourself and your message. That's really important, and nobody teaches that.
That's interesting. You know, I had John McAfee, who was one of the Libertarian Party presidential candidates, who wanted to be a candidate, on the show. And he said that all ideas have a life of their own and cannot be extinguished. And this seems to be something that is, you know, an idea that is great in principle, but seems at risk in universities today. Is there such a thing as a libertarian perspective on education? And do you think that, you know, sort of a libertarian educational approach requires a sort of breadth that you're talking about? I mean, what would a libertarian education look like?
Well, first of all, libertarianism is dealing only with how do we use violence in society. When we disagree with somebody, do we punch them in the face or do we argue with them? That's really what libertarianism is. So as far as libertarianism in education, it would simply say voluntary solutions are better than government ones. Beyond that, then you have to supplement it with your own philosophy, conservatism, whatever it is. But I think that is a very good first step, because when we look at the American – I don't have to tell you this. Look at the American university system, and we ask, are kids getting a good exposure to good, sensible ideas? Kids are being turned into complete lunatics and savages by
these
places.
They're so insane. They're literally like, they're crazy people.
And we subsidize them.
They're crazy people. You know, these kids, I say this in all my talks and it always gets a laugh, and it's still true. I think they come out dumber than when they started. They come out believing in more conspiracy theories. They come out believing more untrue things than when they arrived at college. Less able to deal with the real world. Less well-adjusted. Less able to have meaningful, stable relationships with other people. I mean, they come out messes, don't they?
Oh, and in fact, I'm pretty sure it might have been the Intercollegiate Studies Institute actually did a study where they asked people questions as freshmen, they asked them questions as seniors, and they got more of them wrong at the end.
You know, I've seen this. I remember this. It was about capital cities and things, wasn't it? Because they spend so long on these sort of absurd, abstract conspiracy theories about, you know, white oppression and patriarchy and cishet normative garbage. That they don't.
I'm sure they get 100% on that test.
Right, but they can't remember dates, places, nothing. And you see, there's this great conceptualizing approach to education is all well and good. It's important as a thinker to be able to draw connections between different ideas, to look at the world through different prisms, whether it is a feminist interpretation or a post-structuralist interpretation, whatever. But you need a basic body of knowledge in order to actually do or know or learn anything. You need something on which to build. And these kids don't know anything. They don't know any history. They don't know any geography. They don't know any literature. They know nothing. And this social justice incursion into education is even undermining the specific. I mean, do you hear that story about the law students who said they didn't want to study rape law because it was triggering? I mean, what are these people going to do when they're lawyers and someone comes into the office saying, this guy raped me, I want to sue him because he didn't get prosecuted or whatever? What are they going to do? The lawyer is going to become triggered and the client's going to have to start comforting the lawyer because the word rape triggered the lawyer. I mean, are we serious about this stuff? I don't know how this happened, but it's just.
You know, I was in college in the early 90s, and at that time I thought it was crazy, but that would be considered ultra conservative compared to what students endure today. I wonder what it's like to get through 4 years. I mean, you probably have a lot of kids, I think, just go along with the zeitgeist because they don't want to be ostracized. And who's going to say, you know, I'm not altogether sure diversity is always our strength. You would never be heard from again.
You know, I hope this is true. And I think the numbers of people coming to my talks and the general sort of pushback from students suggests that this might be true. I hope that the social justice warriors are a loud, angry minority. As time goes by, I've become increasingly less convinced of that. But if you, I mean, with your experience in education and on campuses, what's your particular sort of three top pieces of advice, or your one major piece of advice for people who want to resist this sort of profound anti-intellectualism on campus, people who want to push back against this absurd war against free speech, war against common sense, war against fact and reason and logic that's being played out in faculties, in administration buildings, even in course materials? What's the number one piece of advice you would give students who are at university bewildered by this stuff and want to resist it?
I would say be provocative and never, ever apologize. This is not about saying, sorry, I didn't mean to say such and such, and can I please be reintegrated into the community? These people want to destroy you. So don't apologize. That's a sign of weakness. You haven't done anything wrong. When I was in college, I was at Harvard as an undergrad, and we had a dean, Fred Jewett. Fred Jewett was the biggest suck up to all the left-wing student groups. So in our college magazine, our right-wing magazine, every year we had a special insert. It was a special card you could cut out. It was the Dean Jewett suck-up scorecard. And you could check off over the course of the year which group he had pandered to. Of course, he never pandered to us. So, I mean, have fun. Push back and have fun. Because the thing is, these people expect to have intimidated you into silence. So that's, I think, what really triggers them, if I may use that word.
You may.
The
you
fact
may.
That you
I'll give you,
fight
I'll give
back,
you a trigger pass.
And if you fight back vigorously and laugh, okay, good. If you fight back and actually laugh at them because they are drones with no sense of humor, this shakes their confidence that they've actually managed to intimidate into silence. So, frankly, I like your motto. In fact, I sent an email out to my list a few months ago after that. I don't know, probably there have been more than one occasion, but there was a time when you were sitting there and a couple people jumped on the stage and grabbed the microphone away from you. And I had people saying, oh, Milo should have stood up for himself and exerted control. And I said, no, that is exactly what he shouldn't do. We want the country to see that he's just sitting there and these thugs are taking over the event. I mean, the narrative to be so clear.
Well, I suppose that was sort of going on somewhere in the back of my head. Was, you know, actually the best thing to do is just smirk and stare at the floor, which is kind of what I did. I mean, you know, I wasn't completely averse to getting into a wrestling match with that strapping young man, but I thought, you know, I'll just sit here and see if things calm down. Of course, they didn't. I think by now it's becoming obvious to parents, it's becoming obvious to the rest of America that this is not just conservatives causing a fuss about. This is a real thing. And these students are becoming dumber and they're becoming sort of, I don't know what is the opposite of toughened up? Fragilized? I don't even know what the word is. Tenderized, like a steak. They're being beaten with the mallet of social justice. This is a good metaphor. I'm going to use this. They're being beaten with the mallet of social justice, tenderized into these awful wet blankets. It's so depressing. And what's the most depressing about it, I think, is that this disease seems most widespread seems to have infected the most people and seems to have the worst symptoms at the best universities. You've had experience at Harvard and Columbia. I'm going to go and speak at Yale this year. These are some of the worst schools, aren't they? And how did it happen that, you know, that supposedly the greatest colleges in America, which are, you know, they're not Oxford or Cambridge, but they're okay. How is it that the best schools in America have become the ones most infected with this stuff? What do you think?
I honestly don't know. We all tried to figure out what had happened at this place. At the same time, we should remember, believe it or not, even at these places, there is still some good scholarship that takes place. And I say this as I couldn't, when they call me to donate to Harvard, you should hear the responses I give. So I'm not trying to come up with defenses of them, but there is still actual stuff that goes on. It's usually at the lower tier universities where you have faculty members who have no credentials, no qualifications. They're lecturing about the life of women in ancient Greece, and they don't read any of the relevant languages. You don't see that in the Ivy League. I mean, generally, you do have some level of standards, but you also do have propagandists. And so we, as students, we would inform each other, well, this one you have to avoid because it's just going to be, you know, an SJW speech the whole time. We didn't have that term in those days, but we would inform each other. Or there was a class where I was asked to go and buy my books, not at the regular bookstore, but at a store called Revolution Books. And I'll tell you, this was not the Ron Paul Revolution. This was a store with Mao Zedong on the wall, mass murderers on the wall. And I remember I'm this 18-year-old naive going in there, indignantly refusing to go along with all this. I, honest to goodness, I don't know where it comes from.
You'd have been one of these college Republican heroes that I love so much. You'd have been inviting me on campus, wouldn't you?
I was the vice president of the college Republicans.
Well, there we go.
But honestly, I think it's worse on the lesser campuses because at least on the Ivy League campuses, most of the students want to assimilate into the establishment at some point. They don't want to have a whole lot of embarrassing stuff on their record. But these days, the establishment itself is moving leftward.
Well, this is, I was about to say, I mean, being a sort of radical far left conspiracy theorizing feminist or Black Lives Matter activist is no impediment to joining the media now, is it? It is no impediment to being an academic. It is no impediment to a life in politics. It doesn't seem to be a problem if you want to join one of the various elites that run the, you know, the social institutions in America. It doesn't seem to be much of a problem having crazy politics, provided they're in one direction. Do you think that American higher education is going to survive this? Do you think it will get over it? Or do you think there's going to be a sort of fracturing and collapse? I mean, there's obviously, we've seen what happens when former students, when alumni learn what's going on. Donations to Missouri, for instance, collapsed in the wake of their ridiculous social justice spectacle. And that terrible professor, Melissa Click, who asked for muscle to remove a student journalist. When alumni see this going on, they stop in donations. And when applicants see this going on, they stop going to those schools. So Missouri, as you probably know, had such a drop in applicants that they had to close two dormitories. I think they were called Strength and Excellence, which is, of course, what you lose when you pander to social justice. But there are other pressures on universities too, aren't there? There are economic pressures. There are pressures from technology and new ways of educating people and from homeschooling. Do you think that the American higher education system is going to survive this, or is the golden era of the vast and hugely well-funded massive state university basically coming to an end? What do you think?
Well, unfortunately, there are still, I would say, the vast majority of parents who think that social status includes sending your kid off to a school where he's going to rack up a six-figure debt and come out unemployable. They think this is what entitles them to a position in the middle class or the upper middle class, and it's going to be hard to disabuse them of that. But at the same time, the tuition levels are getting ridiculous. I mean, I'm going to pay this much, and then to add insult to injury, you're going to kick me in the teeth all the time by teaching my kids the opposite of what I want them to learn. So there is that. There is the fact that there are universities where you see the administration hitting back, like at the Ohio State University, for example. I think it was one of the vice presidents who went out to the protesters and said, pretty much, if you're still here by X o'clock, we're rounding you all up and arresting you.
Wonderful.
And so they
wasn't that great?
They sheepishly walked away. That was
it. Just like, oh, okay. No, we're brave and valiant warriors for social justice, unless it means that there might be a call to our parents. Demanding that we're removed from premises and penalizing us or something, or letting our parents.
Mom and dad will never let me live this down. But at the same time,
if they take my mobile phone away, or they don't let me have a car in the second semester or something, that's a bridge too far. Never mind. find the deep and ingrained racial injustice, the structural prejudices in society. All of that evaporates. All of that evaporates when the threat of a call to mom and dad is dangled in front of these idiots.
Well, I think once people, you know, I think even the millennials are starting to figure out that the old model that worked in the 80s and 90s, you go to college for 4 years, you get a degree in basically anything, and you automatically get a job. We all know that doesn't work anymore. Yeah. And there are alternatives. Like, there's a great group in the U.S. called Praxis, where they don't encourage you to go off to college. They say, we'll give you an internship in a great entrepreneurial startup that'll give you a lot of experience and a foot in the door and maybe a job offer at the end. And you may find college is totally superfluous. You've saved $100,000 plus 3 years. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Of course. I dropped out twice, in fact. It doesn't seem to have done me any harm. But then, you know, I think people are going to come to realize that there are professions for which going to university is unavoidable. I've got a feeling, however, that colleges are going to start to there's going to be a sort of fracturing in higher education between the loony mainstream and schools which reaffirm their commitment to free speech, free intellectual inquiry, which defend, you know, libertarian and conservative speakers when they come to campus, that stand up for students' rights to hear anything, read anything, think about anything. Those schools may well be in the minority, but I've got a feeling that, it's sort of going to become a kind of a badge of pride. And it shouldn't be. It's an absurd situation where a university can wear a commitment to free speech as a sort of differentiating mark. But I think some universities are going to be able to soon. It's a very sad thing. Now, I want to move on from education briefly, because I would love to get your opinion on a few other subjects, since you are so interesting and learned on everything. On the subject of free speech, there is one person running for president who represents, in my view, a sort of existential threat to political correctness. Somebody who has proven that if you turn around and stick up a middle finger to the hand-wringers, the progressives, the feminists, and all the rest of it, that nothing bad happens. Nobody dies if you double down on your rudeness and you actually get back to speaking common sense and saying what you believe. And that person is, of course, God Emperor Daddy Donald Trump. How do you feel about Mr. Trump? Because I know that a lot of libertarians seem to be split completely down the middle, as far as I can tell. Some of them are sort of, no, the guy's not libertarian, so I'm not voting for him. And others are so in love with the risk that he represents to political correctness. And the, you know, and I think also, there seems to be the more fun, mischievous libertarians who just appreciate how much he upsets all the right people. You know, where do you come down on this?
I think I'm in that third group, because, and I might have been.
My analysis is faulty. That's what you're suggesting to me. I've omitted a crucial third group into which you should be placed. Tell me.
Well, that third group is the I'm amused and I'm enjoying the way he's ruffling feathers. But I only wish Donald Trump could be the guy a lot of his supporters want him to be. It's almost like I listen to him and I say he doesn't even understand his own significance, because the fact that he's reaching out to Rudy Giuliani and a lot of these horrible mainstream nobodies, that alone makes me think he doesn't understand what his own significance is.
You don't like Rudy?
And is it – no. Oh, come
you don't
on.
Like Rudy? Oh,
nothing's
come on.
He's under Rudy.
Oh, I think he's kind of sexy. I think there's something really attractive about Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, you've got to get out. You got to get out of here.
I'm serious.
Talk about being anti-intellectual, right?
He was like such an awesome plain speaker. He was great for the police. No, he saved thousands of black lives by policing those areas properly.
As a prosecutor, he was full of it, you know, against so-called white-collar criminals. He's been terrible. And, of course, if Rudy Giuliani
I knew we'd disagree on something.
Giuliani. Nothing would change in America. Nothing would change. Nothing would change except – no, it would be awful.
But
point is – see, I'm not as optimistic about the U.S. as you are.
Really?
My view is not that, well, if only we could get the Clintons out and get the Bushes back in, maybe things would be fine. No. No,
you think it's all – you think you need to tear down the system, completely rip it up.
Now, if that's what Trump wants to do –
well, I think that's what he represents,
then I'm on
isn't
board.
It? Isn't that what he represents?
I listen to him and then it turns out that he wants to like change 7% of the system or the other day or, you know, on foreign policy, I think, oh, he's going to be great. And then he turns out to be conventional. Or when it comes to the economy, now he's saying, well, maybe we should be borrowing more and building more bridges. The collapsing bridges story is a fake left-wing story. The bridges are not collapsing. That's all made up. That's based on the fact that most American bridges are these little covered bridges in rural Iowa that nobody uses and cars don't even drive over them. These are the sorts of things he should know and should be seeing through. And then when I listen to his speeches, it sounds kind of like, well, you know, look, The problem is that the government has been screwing the white middle class, and now I want to use the government to build up the white middle class. I don't have that much confidence in the government.
Okay, but you know from your study of philosophy, you know, difference between intention and consequence, intention and outcome, right? Could you not entertain the possibility that even though Donald Trump might not know as much as you would like him to know, and even though he might not be committed to the wholesale destruction of the conventional political architecture of America, that that is almost certainly going to be the consequence of his candidacy anyway. I mean, he has torn the Republican Party into, and it deserved to be torn into, because it, you know, it wasn't fit for purpose. It started to go in an ugly direction, I think. You've got Paul Ryan talking about the alt-right. He can't even name it properly. That represents half of his base, really. This sort of, you know, immigration and Western culture aware, you know, mischievous dissident bit of the conservative base now. The most exciting, most vibrant political movement in the country. He's sort of dismissing half of his base in this haughty fashion using the language
I get
of the
that, but the thing is, Trump never stands up and says anything like, look, we're proud to be part of Western civilization, and we want to maintain the beliefs and institutions of Western civilization, and we don't apologize
for
that.
He does, though. He does. I mean, if you think
in a very clunky and unclear way. Again, feel like people like you want him to be saying these things, but he's really not.
Well, you may have a point there. I mean, the rhetoric of Donald Trump is something that there will be books written about. Maybe I'll even do it myself. It's like a sort of a brook, an eddy. You know, there are all these little reversals and repetitions. It's very wildy, actually. It's like a fast-flowing river, and it sort of takes twists and turns, and it's sort of rapid and inexorable, but it somehow still keeps contradicting itself and jumping over itself. And I think the broad brush of what Trump says is consistent, but the individual units of meaning, you know, he speaks basically in a way that no politician, I think has ever spoken before. The way he uses language is remarkable and very interesting, and I think completely unique. And it's one of the reasons I think you can sort of see whatever you want to in a Donald Trump speech. You can read pretty much anything into it, because we're just not used to hearing anybody who communicates in this way, because it's a very weird way to talk.
It's funny, even when he has his planned out speeches, it's so weird. It's like one of these personality ink block tests as to how you interpret it. When he gave not the recent foreign policy speech, but his the America Firsters were saying, hey, it's an America First speech. And the neocons were saying, this is terrible. It was an America First speech. And then I have my anti-war friend saying, no, it was an interventionist speech. It's whatever you're prepared to hear is what you hear.
It's very obvious when he goes off script as well, because he'll sort of come back to life again and make a sort of half-hearted quip, except it won't really land because he hasn't been able to do his normal comedic build-up.
Exactly.
And then he'll go back. And it does, the joke doesn't really land. And then he goes back to the, you know, whatever words are on the screen. I'm just like, no, I want you to throw something at the teleprompter, hurl it out of the window, just be Donald. We love you.
What did you think of that written statement? He was holding it in his hand, I think on purpose so people could see, where he was endorsing Paul Ryan and John McCain. My interpretation of that is he's holding the piece of paper, which, as if you would need that piece of paper to remember I'm supposed to endorse Ryan and McCain.
But it was a brilliant
piece of
political
theater.
It was
a way to say,
theater.
I'm doing what I've been told to do. Is that what you took it as?
Exactly. And he also waited to do it so that people knew that he remembered that Paul Ryan had made him wait for an endorsement.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So he did exactly the same thing back. And then this piece of paper was like the biggest diss, possibly the biggest political diss. My people call it shade, you know, when you throw shade at somebody. This very subtle but absolutely devastating little gesture that speaks volumes, you know? And it's just having this little bit of paper. I think your analysis is exactly right. Having this little bit of paper, which suggests a number of things, any one of which is insulting and awful, like, I've been told to do this, so I'm doing it. Almost like he's a schoolboy that's got to read out his bad grade report, you know? Or it's a piece of paper just in case I forget your names, you know? There's a million different interpretations, all of them horrible. I thought it was wonderful. It puts these people in their place.
That was one of my favorite moments, actually.
Do you know, I love those little moments. And, you know, people very often don't realize the subtle language of politics sometimes. You know, we're used to politicians being boring, and they are boring. But there are some smart politicians, and smart politicians kind of wink at you now and again. And you have to look carefully for those moments. There's a politician called Ken Clark in the UK, who I'm not hugely fond of, but he's a very smooth political operator. And one of the things that he did once that I most enjoyed is he managed to storm out of a TV studio while looking like the grown-up. And the way he did it was very simple. The conversation was going in a direction he didn't enjoy. He was being asked admittedly quite stupid questions. And he sort of said, yeah, you know what? I think I'm done here. And instead of just sort of unhooking himself and storming off, or even just walking off slowly, he picked up his cup of tea and walked off the set very slowly and very deliberately with his cup of tea. And it, I like that. It was just this little moment. Like, it's like, I'm not storming off. I'm just done with this conversation. I've had enough. I think we've achieved everything we can realistically achieve. I'm going to go and finish my cup of tea somewhere else. You know, and it was just a beautiful, tiny little gesture that just let you know that he was completely in control of the situation and wasn't in the least bit pissy or petty or mean or having a hissy fit. He was just done with the, you know, with that conversation. He just had enough. And I thought it was one of those like Jedi moves that occasionally you see and you're like, oh, I see you. But Trump is full of those. Trump does it all the time. He's absolutely masterful at them. People think he's so much dumber than he is. There's, the biggest myth about Donald Trump is that he's an idiot, that he's some kind of blustering moron. I don't understand how people can, you know, see this guy who's basically just been a sort of a real estate mogul and a reality star is now the Republican candidate for president. And you're still telling me this person is dumb?
Well, not only that, if he accomplished nothing else, he permanently and forever destroyed the career of Jeb Bush, who had been chosen as the nominee. No one ever imagined such a thing would happen. So my hat is off to him for that. That everybody has to agree that's a good thing.
It is.
I would also say I just read – I mean basically what disappoints me about him is there isn't a – it's much too much I'm going to help you. I'm going to do this for you. I want a more libertarian message. You know, this regime that rules over you and brainwashes your kids and yeah, frankly, sends them into idiotic left-wing wars. I'm not doing that to you anymore. And I think the whole regime is a problem. It's not that we've had bad people or they're incompetent and I'm going to get the best people. I don't want that kind of message. That distracts people from the real problem. But at the same time, I'll tell you what would excite me is if, let's say, Donald Trump loses. I don't know if you saw this, but on LouRockwell.com, he had an interesting possible concession speech that Trump could give. And, you know, the usual concession speech is, you know, we fought a good campaign, but, you know, let's rally around the new president and hope for the best, whatever. Mm-hmm. He said, no. Trump should come out and say, well, the people have spoken and they've chosen a criminal to rule them for the next 4 years and they're going to regret this. And he says, as of this moment, I am declaring my candidacy for 2020. I will win the nomination. And every single day, I will be following all the mistakes she makes. The economy is going to go downhill. I'm going to show you why. I'm going to tell you what I'm doing about it, what we should do about it. She will be a one-term president. He gives that kind of speech. Mm-hmm. That takes all the air out of her acceptance speech and her victory speech.
It does.
Suddenly,
he becomes the celebrity
that day.
Of course, because he's then the most interesting person on the world stage.
And
her
not only that,
the entire inauguration is overshadowed by the horror of Donald Trump following her every move for 5 years.
Plus, he's got a huge mailing list. What Republican is going to want to run against Donald Trump's mailing list in 2020? If he wants the job, he establishes himself as that person on the night of the defeat.
Wow. Well, that's smart. I mean, if only one of us knew someone close to him. Oh, wait. This will not escape the keen intellects and ears of regular listeners that Steve Bannon, our executive chairman, has just taken up a job. He's taking a leave of absence from Breitbart to go and be Trump's campaign CEO. Well, I can't promise, but I will certainly put it in front of Steve. That sounds awesome. I don't even know if I'm allowed. Am I allowed to communicate with him? I know he's not allowed to be on our emails anymore. I don't know. We'll see.
You could send it to Roger Stone. But
well, I can send it to Roger for sure.
Yeah. Just for the sake of political theater and American history, it's never been done before.
And Trump is the only person who could do it. And Trump would obviously love to do it.
I want to see that. I really want to see
that. Oh, me too. All right. I'm going to let you go, but before I do, the Libertarian Party, Gary Johnson, bit of a train wreck, right? Are you supporting them? Are you telling people to vote for them? And if the answer to either of those questions is yes, how responsible would you feel in the event of a Hillary presidency?
Oh, well, okay. First of all, I'm not telling people to vote for them.
I always have a mean question. I always have to have one mean question, even with people I love as much as I love you. We have one mean question, and this is your mean question, so go.
No, look, I actually spoke at the LP National Convention this year. It was to a luncheon crowd.
The LP.
Libertarian Party National Convention.
Yeah, you're like Liberal Democrats in the UK. You've got this Byzantine system of abbreviations and terminology. Libertarians, well, because, you know, I'm semi-libertarian, not really. I'm a cultural libertarian. I don't know about the political, economic libertarianism. I tend to think they're a bit daft, but I'm a semi-libertarian. I, too, like most libertarians, I'm a dork and love abbreviations and rules and systems.
All right, well,
I'm sorry for calling you up. I just had to pass it for our listeners who are not immediately familiar with this kind of world. No, so your LP, what was it, your national convention?
Yeah, it was the party's national convention.
Is this the naked guy thing?
I'm afraid it is.
Oh, God. I tweeted that at the time with, this is what a libertarian looks like.
it's a horror show sometimes, but there are a lot of great, wonderful people there, too. But basically, I've made no secret on my – I mean, look, I've said nice things about Gary Johnson in the past, and I've met him, and we've always been friendly and have no problem with him. But I guess I just feel like he's had 4 years to, I don't know, become more knowledgeable, to be a better spokesman, to be more hardcore. I don't know what. And yet he's the same, frankly, dull, uninspiring guy he always was.
He's not very smart,
his message is, let's take the best from the Democrats and the best from the Republicans and bring them together. What?
That's literally the opposite of libertarianism.
and not only that, why shouldn't he instead, in a year when populism is all the rage, why shouldn't he say, look, there is no best of the Democrats? No. What we need is the exact opposite of these people.
Can you imagine?
And that's what I represent.
Can you imagine if he just come out and said, the religious right of the 1990s was a horror show. The social justice, feminist, progressive left of today, you know, policing everyone, calling you all racist, sexist, transphobes, homophobes, is a horror show. I want you to be able to say, do, think, and be whatever the hell you want. This is America. You should be free. He'd get a vast, vast number of people would say, you know what? Sorry, Trump, I'm going. He would get such huge support. I mean, of course, it would guarantee a Hillary presidency, but it would, you know, it would sort of make the Libertarian Party a serious thing to be reckoned with, and a movement that the GOP would have to take into account in future and perhaps attempt to absorb, and what might move them in a good direction, you know? It's remarkable to me that libertarians are so politically stupid. Maybe that's because I find
him to be basically a complete bore in the way he presents the message. And then if you ask him a really – I mean, there are a lot of tough questions you could ask libertarians. I mean, hard questions you could ask. He never seems prepared for any of them, and yet you have to know they're coming. and when he does get a
kind
tough
of your
question,
thing.
You know, like the whole bake the cake question. I mean, he doesn't know what to say.
What's the cake question for people who don't know?
Oh, it's the whole question of, believe it or not, this is a huge controversy in the U.S., whether a Christian baker...
Oh, the Christian baker, of course. No, of course I know this. Yeah, of course, sorry. Yeah. This is a question that a libertarian candidate should have a bulletproof answer to immediately.
Yeah, pretty good, yeah, right. And he, you know... And
whatever that answer is.
You know? Yeah, right, exactly. And then the most recent version is they should bake the cake but not have to frost it. I mean, what...
But you see what I mean when I say libertarians are like, they're sort of hilariously dorky, you know, they're just sort of like, well, let's talk about the frosting. I mean, this is why you people are nuts. Okay.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that he did get a decent number of votes last time, but what is very revealing is the party didn't grow at all. Like, nobody said, I'm so inspired by Gary Johnson that I'm going to go join the Libertarian Party and change my life. No, they just said, I'll vote for this guy.
So it's more of an expression of disaffection with the establishment and the two main parties than it is an endorsement of him or libertarians.
Exactly. With Ron Paul, people were abandoning their careers so they could go campaign for the guy.
Yeah, people loved Ron Paul. They loved him so much. Do you think that if the Libertarian Party had picked somebody like McAfee, he could have been quite a compelling foil to Trump in terms of charisma and star power? And I mean, I had McAfee on the show, and you know, he speaks with more authority and expertise on technological issues, for instance, than anybody I've ever heard running for, you know, for big office. I mean, he could have really captured the youth vote, couldn't he, if they put McAfee up?
That would have been my view, even though, you know, he's like Gary Johnson, is not a pure libertarian on everything. But if it's an election season where there's a lot of focus on this popular media figure, well, why not go with that? Go with a strong personality, because that guy has a strong personality and would have been fun to watch. Yeah.
It would have been a hoot. It would have been a hoot. All right. This has been a fascinating conversation. I hope you'll come on again.
Anytime.
I've had a wonderful time talking to you. This has been the Miley Yiannopoulos Show. First off, we discussed my privilege grant. We didn't even get time to talk about the privilege grant. My scholarship fund for straight white males, which is swinging into action soon. But we have spoken very interestingly about Trump, about libertarianism, and about the state of American higher education. Tom Woods, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right, that is our week. TomWoods.com/724. We'll have a link to the Milo Yiannopoulos Show, and we'll have a link to Milo's previous appearance on this show. So check that out, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.